Hello and welcome to the Crate and Crowbar. This is episode 127, recorded on the 2nd of February, 2016-ish. And I'm Tom Francis. With me here today are...
Marsh Davis.
And...
Tom Senior.
And...
Graham Smith.
They're all on top form tonight. What is the news, Graham?
There's many game releases, but the only one I'm really interested in is the release of Crusader Kings 2 Conclave, which is the new DLC for Crusader Kings 2, but it also comes with a patch, which just is free to all users. And my coworker Alice at Rock Paper Shotgun pulled out some particularly fine patch notes, which I've taken a photo of with my phone. Eunuchs can no longer use seduction focus.
Fair.
Blamed chancellors should no longer look inappropriately at your spouse. Being pregnant now gives you a -2 personal combat skill modifier.
Nice.
Your eunuch sons will no longer get the serving maids pregnant. A fix that should stop the humans giving birth to horses. No longer blocks female horses from being on the council.
What?
Which is just, what? Why? That seems like the opposite of a fix. Muslims, unless they are sinful, will no longer die from poisoned wine.
Oh my god.
What was the horse one again?
The game no longer blocks female horses from being on the council.
Right. There must be a historical precedent.
Well, wasn't there a horse made a consul in either Greece or Rome or whichever?
How dare a strategy game not simulate that particular event?
I don't know what relevance that has to, you know, European history post the 13th century, whenever.
There's a regiment of the Welsh army that have a goat as sort of their mascot, but also just as a soldier. He has a rank. And they just 2 weeks ago introduced a new goat. I guess their old goat must have passed away, but I missed that news story.
Maybe died in the line of duty.
Yeah. So he's a private now or something like that in this Welsh army, paraded down the street wearing his finery. Very good.
You don't want to be outranked by a goat.
You don't want your spouse to be ogled by a blind man. But that's it. That's all the news there is.
Excellent. The other news is that lots of games came out, as you mentioned. There's loads that came out, and then there's loads that are about to come out. And there are enough that came out that I still haven't played Homeworld, annoyingly. I was really excited about that before it came out. And then right after it came out, The Witness and Tomb Raider came out. And at least three of us have been playing both of those things. Have you played either of those things, Graham?
I haven't played either of those things, no.
What have you been playing?
I've been playing The Division, or Tom Clancy's Destiny, as it ought to be called. I'm not sure if this was always the case, but it's quite Destiny now. The Division, if you don't know, is a third-person cover shooter with MMO bits set in a New York, which I think is disaster struck as a result of some sort of disease or virus or plague.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Transmitted by money, I believe.
Is it?
Oh, God. Yes.
Okay. Oh, topical. And it's beautiful to look at. New York looks fantastic. It's all covered in snow. There's burnt out cars everywhere, but
beautiful.
The lighting is really nice. And so it's great to walk around. But although it's a cover shooter, and although you have machine guns and it's a Tom Clancy game and you're kind of, you know, doing a vaguely Rainbow Six-y or at least Splinter Cell-ish things, you're hiding behind low walls, popping out, shooting grubby looking men in hoodies in the head and stuff like that. It borrows a lot from Destiny in both its structure, but also in its combat in weird ways. The weirdest being that, you know, Destiny is based around you kill a bunch of grunts and then there's maybe like a kind of boss character who's got more health points and you just have to pump them full of bullets in order to take them down. And that sort of works in Destiny when you've got laser guns and what you're fighting against are giant aliens. You can imagine that they would, you know, hold up against that kind of assault. But when it's just another man in a hoodie, but this one has a name, doesn't entirely make a great deal of sense that you just have to shoot them 50 times rather than everyone else who takes about 15 times. And it sort of undermines a lot of that game's fantasy that's being communicated through the art style and through the fact that it's got relatively realistic guns. Like, I haven't dug into it enough to know if the machine guns are actual machine guns with actual names or anything like that, but they're certainly modeled to look like you're using a Colt M4A1 or something like that. But there's nothing to signify why is this hoodie guy any stronger than the others, other than one of your little NPC mates will yell out, "Kill the leader! Kill the leader!"
I think leadership just makes you strong. Comparing to taught us anything, it's that the higher you rise in an organization, the more layers of armor are added to your skin.
I am much harder to take down than anyone else at RPS. This is true. But that aside, there's lots I like about it other than the world. Like, it's the beta that's, I think, just ended today, went on over the weekend, only had a single story mission on it. But the idea is that you're part of some sort of special military group brought in to try and bring order back to New York. But the hook of the story missions that you're doing is that each one gives you something that allows you to improve your home base. And so I think it's like New York Public Library or something like that. And the story mission that's in the beta is you arrive, it's derelict, it's full of shit. But then you go to Madison Square Garden and you rescue a medic, and she becomes the head of your medical wing, and her kind of one wing of this building, kind of the models update, so it's a bit cleaner and a little bit tidier. And then you can, that's like a path that you can play down in the story missions, is to get, do stuff to get her more medical equipment to like pad out your base.
And so everyone's doing that same chain of missions.
Yeah, so your base is unique to you.
The library.
Yeah, but they're all in the same place. So it's like, it's that kind of thing of it's like Destiny. It's a bit MMO-y, but really it's all just instanced stuff. Yeah. And it does like a really good seamless job of, as you're walking around the world, you'll just see other players run by, you'll turn a corner and it will spawn some little looting grunt men for you to shoot and kill, and maybe other players will be fighting against them, and you can help them out, and you get little side rewards for that. And the other thing it's got going on is the Dark Zone. If you enter the Dark Zone, that's an area which is still, I guess, contaminated with whatever money virus has caused everyone to be poisoned. And the effect of that is that that's the area where it's PvP. The money virus allows you to kill other players, whereas everywhere else they're just immune to your gunfire. And that allows you to do things like, you go in there because there's greater rewards, basically. It's greater risk because other players can kill you, but you get much better loot for your character or for your base by going in there. But in order to extract that loot, you have to call in an extraction, which basically sends up a flare in the world that every other player in the vicinity can see. So what it's trying to do is incentivizing you to go in, not on your own, but with a team of friends. So you and three or four other players go in, try and get this loot, and try and hold off other players with the risk that you might turn on one another in order to get the lion's share of the loot or something like that.
Like in that video where the guy does that and it makes you think, I don't want to play this game because it just seems like we'll all fuck each other over.
What that video, I think, did a really poor job of communicating is that that's just one area of the world. And it seems like that's probably the most interesting part of the game. But there is, you know, a vast other part of the game where you don't have to do that at all, where you can just either solo missions or co-op missions where there is no PvP. When it introduced my base and the camera zoomed around and it showed me the potential tech wing and the medic wing and kind of explained that, I know it's sort of grindy, but there was a little buzz in my stomach of like, ooh, that's satisfying progress.
I can upgrade this.
I like the idea of upgrading this, but I'm not sure that the combat stuff really does it for me. And I played a bit of Destiny up to like level 12 with a single character or something, which is, in the grand scheme, is nothing. But enough that I liked the combat, I liked the guns, I liked the fact that you could spawn a hover bike at any moment between your legs and go shooting off and spinning around. I liked the nice, satisfying first-person stab animation that's just nabbed from Call of Duty.
You're very mobile in that game, aren't you? I mean, the combat in that game is going to be more dynamic than it is in The Division because you've got crazy guns that do lasery stuff and other things.
And The Division, as far as I can tell, has no facility for mounts. And it's third person, so it's immediately less satisfying in terms of any melee stuff that it might do. And it's quite realistic weapons with quite unrealistic damage, which means there's no satisfying headshots or anything like that. So it's an odd mixture of a game that I almost really want to play, but almost think I'll probably just get bored by level 6, probably.
Yeah, without good shooting, the rest is pointless for me. That's the point. It's Diablo for me. And I'll go in there with my friends and kill some men in hoodies. But if that crunch isn't there, that moment of satisfying cooperative kind of head popping, the rest is moot. This is why. Why would I grind away getting slightly better contaminated gloves and shoulder pads, which add kind of incremental percentage improvements to my ability to resist damage or target things or recoil? Very boring kind of stat progression. The RPG side of it felt very unsatisfying to me, the bit I played. Whereas in Destiny, you know, if a gun gets a certain roll, then, you know, it could just refill your clip at the end of having shot a guy. It does magic things because magic things are allowed in that universe. And every time you fire a gun in Destiny, it feels amazing. Headshots feel incredible. And, you know, depending on the race you've just headshotted, they've got a completely different animation kind of dynamic to that. That
my species explodes like this.
Killed thousands of them. And I will kill thousands and thousands more, and it will always be satisfying, that moment. And that's the Bungie magic of you know, having made Halo for so long and just knowing how to do that. And for me, there's absolutely none of that whatsoever in The Division. Like, every interaction with the world for me felt flat. I hate the interface, which is just a total...
Really?
Yeah, I couldn't stand it. It's just they've built this beautiful kind of ruined New York, and then drawn fucking lines all over it, just meaningless lines. And, you know, an objective marker is fine, but I don't need a floating line that it hovers in the sky and points me around corners to it. I certainly don't need my, like, health and ammo and grenades and medkit stats in a big rectangle just to the right of my character, bobbing up and down as he jogs along. What's wrong with the bottom left corner? Like every other game, man. It feels like the whole central area of the screen when enemies appear, and it just becomes full of all this kind of polygonal bullshit that gets in the way of even shooting the men. And shooting the men isn't good anyway. So it's this extra layer between me and I'm supposed to be throwing these deadly bullets into this world. And there's so many layers between you and the reality of that, that it's just completely... neutered for me, and there's no way I'll play it basically. I love the idea of it, and if it was a kind of a really high lethality shooter, cooperative shooter closer to DayZ, I would have been well into it. But all of the kind of MMO bullshit they put in there, and all necessity that those environments aren't big enough to fill them with a lot of enemies. So in Destiny, you have these big wide open areas, and the dropships can swoop in and drop a dozen guys.
Yeah.
And there could be a dozen guys over here. They can only be like three or four guys in a street in The Division, and that's why they have to have so much health. Otherwise, there would just be no friction as you move through the environment. So I think there's just some kind of conceptual flaws with it. Problems with making that type of game in that type of space that they will never conquer.
It feels like a game that's changed an awful lot during development, and they were quite frank on a recent press trip about saying, yeah, it has been redesigned a bunch, and we have taken things from Destiny, and they were quite open about that inspiration. Because it doesn't feel like the combat looked when it was first revealed at E3 like 2 or 3 years ago now, where it did seem more Splinter Cell-ish, like not DayZ, but, you know, a few shots, take down a bad guy kind of thing. I agree that I would much rather it was still that game.
Oh, well.
sort of wish they'd just jettison at this point the, you know, Tom Clancy name. just call it, keep The Division, because that's all anyone ever calls it anyway. No one ever's going to call it Tom Clancy's The Division, and make it a bit sci-fi. Have it be that your lore, you know, of the virus, it's an alien virus now, and now we've studied the aliens, and now we've got super powered laser weapons and mutant guys. You know, make it Left 4 Dead. Why can't it just be Left 4 Dead?
Speaking of aliens and awesome mutant weapons,
yeah,
I've been playing XCOM 2.
Damn you!
Which is unbelievably good. I think they've absolutely nailed it in a way that I've could never have hoped they would.
I read in a Steam update that splashed on my screen and the screens of probably 125 million people that you said that we'll play it forever.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really weird when something you've written suddenly becomes part of the marketing of the thing that you've reviewed. But I will play it forever, I think. One of the brilliant things about it is that it's designed to be very replayable. And the genius of it is there's so many good decisions they've made about it. But it's the way it restricts the player's choice in the right areas and then gives you a lot of choice in other areas. So moving through the campaign map is very different now. And you're often faced by a relatively limited number of choices about where you're going to park your big ship next and what you're going to research next, what you're going to pursue next. But all of the kind of, it gives you loads of options when it comes to actually building your squad and upgrading different abilities and unlocking different classes, pursuing different divergent technologies. And it gives you a lot more ways to kind of theory craft and express your own way of playing the game than was ever present in an Enemy Unknown. But I guess to give a brief overview of what they've done with it is that basically, in keeping with a very pessimistic atmosphere that will persist throughout the entire game, you lost the campaign that you went through in Enemy Unknown. So in Enemy Unknown, you're like this international coalition of special forces that's trying to repel an alien invasion. And if you get through it, you do, and that's great. Except you don't. That never happens. Yeah, actually, the aliens completely won. And it's like 20 or 30 years later. And the XCOM project still exists, but it's this kind of really scrappy band of resistance that's not in contact at all. They just kind of exist independently throughout the world.
Are you the same person? Are you playing as the guy who lost the last campaign?
Commander.
I won't. There's some story stuff around that.
Oh, okay.
So I won't spoil anything. But yes. Yeah, so it basically reverses the situation. So instead of being in this stationary base and having loads and loads of people and the world's resources at your hands, you're in this recovered flying alien spaceship with loads of different kind of stories to it. And that's where you literally have one scientist and one engineer and one guy called Central who doesn't do anything.
He stands exactly between the other two.
and you're down to just dozens of people, and maybe you have 10 soldiers, it's about building up from there and moving from place to place, establishing contact with adjacent territories, making contact with resistance groups, right, protecting them when the enemy counterattacks, then following through with story missions. And occasionally you'll get like a choice to hit one of three locations, and that will damage the aliens in some way. And those choices of combat or mission, you always have about six or seven at any given time in the campaign, even though you have this big global map, and you might expect there to be a lot of decisions to be made on that map. Actually, they've really, really focused the campaign and where you go and how you progress into this incredibly streamlined path that doesn't feel like it's restrictive. What it's actually done is they've just stripped away all of the busy work that you are always doing in strategy games. So you choose. Time is still, and you choose to spend time in certain locations. So you plant yourself on top of this resource bit, and you'll say, this will take 3 days, and the timer ticks down quickly, 3 days. And during that time, you could be interrupted by alien attack, research can be completed, and etc. But you actually choose where your time goes, and you can never have everything. It's all the time you're making these very important choices between, I need these alloys, or I need an engineer, or I need to pick up this other guy. And you're always sacrificing all the time. Every single move of the game is sacrificing. And it puts you into this, it's incredibly tense. It felt to me like I was always on the edge of just a downward spiral that would destroy me. And the enemy design is extremely punishing in ways that I literally thought, I won't actually describe them because you have to encounter them for yourself and be screwed over by them. So actually it's part of the fun on your first campaign. But where I just threw my hands up and said, this is impossible. There's this one, just the single individual unit who wanders into the screen who is just berserk. The things they could do, it's just broken. There's no way this is fucking, I had like such a short time to review this. And I was like, I'm just not ready. I can't do it. I just can't do it. And I've played strategy games all my life, and this thing is like, how could they put this in? It's bullshit. What? And then 6 hours later, I know how to pop them now. And
it didn't take you 6 hours to defeat the one thing, right?
No. It fucked me right up immediately. Because it was kind of an ambush scenario as well. The way it actually comes into the fight, you're kind of pursuing other objectives when it appears, and then it's like, oh crap! It's they put a boss fight in XCOM, and then it does the thing that God of War does, where that just becomes an actual enemy that you're now going to face from now on. And there's this continuous escalation. That's just ahead of, for me, my technological and kind of my skill at playing the game. Like, I was always slightly behind the game in a way that was very, very exciting and always very, really good. And they've improved almost every aspect of it. So levels and missions are procedurally generated. The maps are really, really exciting and varied, and lots of kind of vertical variation. So in urban areas, we get like 3 or 4 story buildings with like city streets full of beautiful futuristic cars. These things can be set on fire and they gradually crumble over time. And, you know, there's this structural integrity now to the buildings where if the building's on fire and you're in that area, your units can fall through the floor because the floor is just kind of burning away and they'll take damage. And all these kind of incidental accidents can happen all the time that throw you off your plan. They've absolutely killed it.
There was something strange about XCOM Enemy Unknown where before you properly understood it, you could easily screw yourself because your funding was based on the number of satellites you launched. Mm. And to launch satellites, you needed some money. And you also needed to dig out some space to plant some control centers or whatever for the satellites. And all that took time. And if you hadn't done it, you know, at the point that you realized you needed to have done it, it was already kind of too late and you're just in this downward spiral. And so it was always about like the better you had to get on all that stuff that's important right away. And then if you did that, you'd be on good footing and the game kind of got easier and easier. And if you didn't, it would just get harder and harder and destroy you. Is there anything like that? Have they kind of fixed that spiral problem?
Yeah, they fixed the spiral problem, but they've kept the equivalence of those. There is a sort of equivalent to satellites. It's not the same at all. But so you have to, it's this constant expansion you have to do where there's a doom bar at the top of the at the top of the kind of strategic layer.
A delicious ale.
It's counting upwards to this unknown catastrophe. And it goes up quite slowly. But the way you get it down is by destroying the bases that are kind of fueling it. And these bases will be uncovered gradually. But they'll always be like 1 or 2 territories away from where you are. So it's pushing you outwards into the world and kind of making that a resource concern. But because you can see the timer, it's not like satellites, which was a very invisible way of screwing you over. Yeah. So you've always got a lot of turns and you've always got a lot of kind of time to make the risk-reward decisions. Like, when am I going to consolidate? Am I going to push out? And that's the central kind of tension of XCOM 2, actually, is do I sit here and improve myself, or do I stretch forward and risk everything? And that carries through to their equivalent of the terror missions, which are called retaliation attacks, where it's similar to Enemy Unknown. The aliens, there are a load of civilians on the map, and the aliens will be moving across it, and you're moving across it, and you're trying to rescue them, and the aliens are trying to kill them. And you get some of the most surprising horrible enemy units turning up for those missions, and when they roll around between like 3 and 6 weeks, so you never quite know when they're going to hit. So it creates this brilliant kind of, you can predict things to a certain extent with the doom bar or with these retaliation missions, but there's always that uncertainty. Like, you can never quite be certain, and it's always this brilliant feeling of being unsettled and desperately striving for things. And that even filters down into the tactical layer, where there are a lot more missions where you have to reach something or hack something, and you've got a tight term limit. And if you don't get it within that time, obviously the objective fades, and you don't get any of the rewards for the mission. But there's this because you have to move faster, you'll be much more easily punished. So it gets rid of this thing that everyone used to play Enemy Unknown by just being very conservative and putting everyone overwatch and moving like 2 guys forwards and then leapfrogging them. But it's always thrust pushing out of your comfort zone with objectives this time around in a way that's really horrible, but really dramatic. So the systems-driven drama in strategy games, I think it's unbelievably good.
What was your favourite soldier in your campaign?
I resurrected Sergeant Balls from my Enemy Unknown playthrough.
Excellent.
But he died almost immediately. So that I was hoping he would be the
all
one.
All is lost.
You were supposed to be the one, Sergeant Balls. But no, actually, it ended up being Sarah Connor. because you could recreate recreated a badass version of Sarah Connor. And she's a the new classes are great. So she was a sniper, but snipers can also be incredibly good with pistols. And it's all their entire playstyle revolves around looking like looking completely badass all the time, no matter what they're doing. So with the pistol, you can pistols are much better now. But if you upgrade them to a certain extent, they could shoot three or four things in a single turn. So they're great for executing a load of low level enemies, and when they do it, they look fucking awesome. So these, like, badass revolvers and the camera shots they use and the production values are fantastic as well. It really sells this kind of super soldier idea. Yep, she was awesome. She died. She died as well.
Does it still make a little shrine to your lost soldiers in your base with like photos of them pinned to a wall?
What they do, there's actually an entire bar dedicated to the remembrance of your soldiers. So you go into the bar and you actually see your soldiers hanging out in there who have survived, and they're all just, I think the idea is they're all kind of toasting the memories of their of the fallen, and you see the names of the fallen and the names of the operations they died on, and the operation names are brilliant. So like, there's one called Dismal Window. I lost a load of people on Operation Half Eaten Tears. That's a good one. I guess there's a theme of pessimism running through it. This theme of kind of really being up against it and again, you know, fighting this ridiculously advanced force.
Yeah, they like the way individual soldiers sort of evolved and how their things they've been through tied into equipment I'd given them and how I distributed my resources and how they leveled up and the names they got and the nicknames they got and then like the relationships to each other. That was always the best part of Anime Unknown for me.
They've increased. There's so much more kind of customization just visually and with voices. And
do they still have the awful Guile haircut?
No, I just didn't see that in there actually. Might do.
There was like a couple of comedy ones, and one was like the ridiculous. Actually, there's like a huge fan of hair, and it was like, who is the Mubari ambassador in Babylon 5?
Yeah.
<That guy. laughs>
Yeah, isn't that a reference to the very first XCOM?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Soldiers, the pixel art soldiers in that, didn't they?
Yeah.
Have ridiculous bouffants.
There's a lot of modding, moddability. It's very moddable. So yeah, I expect people are going to be adding very silly haircuts and things to it. It's not in there already.
A bunch of us have been playing The Witness.
We have, yeah. Played a bit last week, talked about it a bit last week. Played it more this week. I think I'm on the final set of puzzles now.
I read something that, there's, seven sets of puzzles and you only have to solve five or something. Because it was an interview with John Blow and he said that there are some way you can't solve them. Like, if you're deaf, you can't solve ones that have audio. And obviously, you know, there's ones that are completely impossible if you're colorblind. And so maybe you don't have to do them all.
That's certainly true in certain areas where I think you have to solve a puzzle in each area and unlock the laser cannon for each area. But I think you don't need to solve all the puzzles in an area to unlock a laser cannon, which is why I was telling you. In fact, I was surprised because I did like half the puzzles in one area and it unlocked the laser cannon. I was like, what the other half do? I spent ages working through them laboriously and it just do anything. It's like, fuck.
But is that the castle with the mazes?
Yes, yeah.
That's good to know, because I one type of puzzle in that, I looked at them, I did one of them, and I was like, and then there's a bunch more, and I just thought, oh, I don't want to do more like that.
Really like those puzzles. That's the weird thing. It's interesting hearing people come away from this game, because other people reported that they hate certain puzzles. I really like those ones, and the ones they really like, I loathe.
I really hated the ones where you're building bridges out of mazes.
Yes, puzzles. I hated that.
My god, I stopped playing at that point.
Yeah, that's the star one in the treehouse, right?
Yeah.
I've just started that one.
We should probably
avoid sort of spoiling methods for some puzzles.
Yeah, we'll talk about mechanics at all. But
I'm the only one here who hasn't played the game at all yet. So all I know about it is the pre-release stuff. And apologies if you covered this in the last episode, but is it a game entirely about completing small mazes on a screen?
Yep. Okay. Pretty much. It's got like so it's that's your input method. That's how you input your solutions. And in many cases, there's a lot of puzzles where there'll be a maze and you've got to get like every panel has a beginning, sometimes several beginnings, and an end, sometimes several ends, and you have to draw from a beginning to an end, satisfying certain rules, and the rules are what change with each thing. And for a bunch of them, it's just like there are certain symbols on the maze and those mean different things. And it never tells you what they mean, but it'll. One of the things that it's best at is giving you a sequence of puzzles that start absurdly simple where you just can't fail. And the next one's just one step more complex than that in a way that sort of forces you to grasp something about what that symbol means. And the next one will just be a little bit one step further. And it's brilliant at knowing what you think, because as soon as you think, oh, I have to do it in this way, the next puzzle will be the one that proves you don't have to do it in that way. There's some other way to do it. But then there's other ones where there's loads of them where the maze is just blank. It's just a maze. There's a beginning and end, and there's just nothing else on the board. And I actually got a bit kind of fed up of that, like a little while after going through the first sort of easy sections that you start near, and going around the rest of the world and seeing what else is available. And I got to like five different sections where just everything was just completely blank. Just like, come on. I mean, with like, I can get that maybe one of these I'll be able to see some abstract way to solve it, but they can't all be different and yet completely blank. But they are. But luckily there are, it's weird because the structure of it is it's one big open island, and you can go to any of these sections. There's, I think, seven main sections, and each one will have sort of about 20 puzzles in it. I guess more than that, because it's apparently there's 600 puzzles in the game in total, but there's also a large number of kind of secret or sort of one-off puzzles that just are lying around. There's one series that feels like a running joke to me, because for the most part it's really well balanced, and the difficulty is very well defined by the structure. So the first puzzle in each sequence is easy, and then it builds up gradually. But every now and then I just find a puzzle panel just lying on the floor, and it's always just got like one symbol on it that I still don't really know what it means, but it seems like, oh, I guess it looks a bit like in this thing, so maybe I just do this, and I do it, and it's just this bing. And it's not plugged into anything, it doesn't seem to do anything. And then like 20 minutes later I'll find another one just lying on, in the grass, and it's a bit different but basically the same, and I just do it again and it goes bing. I guess I feel good about this, I guess I'm doing the right thing, but I don't know.
I guess maybe that's nice if you're stuck and wandering around.
Yeah.
Find a little thing like, look, you can do this.
There are definitely times in this game where I would have loved a puzzle lying on the ground that I could just do. But yeah, it's weirdly, compared to Braid, which I love, Braid has, I think, maybe two puzzles in it that I don't like, that I think should either have been drastically different or not in there at all. And the rest of it's just super consistent, and just every puzzle is so well judged and genius. And this is has just has so fucking many puzzles, and they're very different, not just in, you know, now you have to change your brain in this way, but just sort of some of them are intellectual, deep thinking ones, and then some of them are just incredibly shallow. They're just sort of very trivial thing that you just have to do again and again. And one of them, there are some where just you do something. His claim that there's no filler and that each puzzle introduces a new concept is extraordinary to me. Because I don't want to give a worse impression of the game than I have, because I really like it, and it's got loads of great stuff, and it's easy enough to justify your the $40 price or 30 quid. But there's also a lot of stuff in it that just seems like, obviously there's difference of opinion about which puzzles are interesting and which ones are not, but then also just within a certain set of puzzles, once you've grasped the initial concept, the idea that each of the 25 stages of that puzzle are a unique concept is surely untenable. I can't think anyone could believe that, because there's just ones where you just solve it and it's like, but can you do that standing over here? Can you do it standing over here? Can you do it from this angle? Can you do it from that angle? Can you do it where you have to press a switch and then do it? Yeah, I can do that. What if you had to press this switch? What if you had to press two switches? What if the switch was over there? What if the switch was in the dark? I don't care.
Yeah, there's more of that the further you go into it. I think particularly as it starts combining the different puzzle types that you've learned across the game, and in the end stages it's throwing all of these things at you simultaneously, it kind of runs out of steam and starts just making the puzzles difficult for you to solve, but in ways which don't relate to the actual kind of logic of the puzzle. They just make things hard to see, for example. That's really not at all interesting. That's just annoying. I'm with you. I think a couple of the areas could go entirely, and the game would be much, much better for it. Just because it would be leaner and more interesting. I don't think some of the puzzled variants that it has are particularly. They're not. For example, the star puzzles, without explaining what they do, they're not substantially conceptually different enough from some of the other puzzles you've got. But the way that they escalate doesn't follow any kind of logic. It just introduces new arbitrary rules. And the problem I have with that primarily is not only does that feel kind of just not not particularly intellectually satisfying to work your way upwards through. But also when you come back to a puzzle which includes those mechanics later on in some complex form, I've completely forgotten like the three or four arbitrary rules that you know define the way that you're meant to make the puzzle work.
I think it's very successful in the kind of sprint puzzles where it's just the concept is revealed to you and iterated on in about 10 to 15 puzzles. And there are a couple like the symmetry one and the tree one, which were just very short bursts of kind of discovery that were incredibly satisfying. And there's a, not to spoil anything, but a lot of the puzzles tie into the environments in very innovative ways as well.
Yes, it's not just about the iPad puzzles, it tends to kind of tie everything back to the iPad at the end. There's sometimes logic to be gleaned from the world at large, or even just, you know, puzzles of traversal as well. Like, you know, the... I can't explain. But that's what I'm saying.
Is it clear where you go to find that solution? Like, is it, like the one thing?
Not always.
The thing I would worry about is, oh, I'm stuck in this puzzle. I don't know what to do. I don't know whether I need to just look at it and think harder, or whether I need to go now explore a forest.
I've had a lot of problems like that. There are lots of ones where the answer is in the environment and it's very close by. And so I want to believe that that's the rule, that if it's in the environment, it's going to be right next to you. But there's these series of three puzzles that are just, again, blank mazes. And I've even solved other puzzles of the type that looks visually similar. So I know what kind of thing I'm looking for, but I just don't see anything anywhere near. And there's just nothing to go on. And so I'm worried that the solution is elsewhere. And if that's true, that just breaks the whole thing. Because now every time I'm stuck, I'm thinking, well, maybe I just have to walk 100 meters over there and the solution will be over there or something.
I do love it though.
Yeah,
I should say
it's really beautiful to walk around, and several of the sets of puzzles are brilliant, and you know, really clever with the way they play with your brain, and they know what you're thinking, like I say, and will subvert those expectations and play with them. There was a great one. I really like the swamp puzzles, and that's one where I had done the first couple and it was all pretty basic, and liked the concept, and I got to one and I solved it. And often there's like a cable running through the puzzle, and when you solve it, it lights up the other side and the current is flowing and it activates the next thing. And I solved it. It made the solved noise, but the cable didn't light up. And I couldn't see what I'd done wrong, so it just seemed to be that's definitely a valid solution. It fulfills all the rules that that I learnt, but it just hasn't lit up. And I almost thought it could be a bug, and then just wandered off and did other stuff. And then I mentioned that to Marsh, who's already done those puzzles, and he said, just give it another go. And I went back to it and just sort of grasped something about what the... like. I already knew all the rules. I was absolutely correct. My solution is valid. But it's just, what does that panel do and why are you interacting with it and what does it represent and ways it ties into other things that were like, once you get it, it's like, oh, for fuck, of course it's that. But it's a proper like head fuck. You have to just get out of your mode of thinking completely and go into a different one. And then it's got stuff about how the environment ties into it. Things like clues you have to notice in the environment. It's a very weird place because it's incredibly artificial, even though they've made lots of efforts to make parts of it look very natural, and they, you know, had architects to make sure the buildings were completely authentic and could exist. It's also a completely false reality. So like many puzzles depend on the exact position of the sun that if it were the real world, the sun would move and all those puzzles would be broken immediately. Like in 5 minutes, half the puzzles would just be completely broken. So it's not like they overlooked that. Obviously that's intentional. So it's not taking place in a real place as far as I can tell, or maybe time is frozen some way. I don't know any of these answers. So
it's very odd kind of biome separations as well, which is part of what makes the island fun to explore, because you're suddenly, there's loads and loads of variation to it, and that's great. But you are just... Here's the desert bit, and here's the swamp bit, and here's the village bit, and but obviously it's fun, but it's deliberately constructed. But of course, that's kind of part of the game as well.
And then a weird consequence of that is, like, because it's puzzle solutions are sometimes sort of coded into the environment in ways that, you know, don't make sense for nature, and obviously have been set up intentionally. But it drives you mad because you're always stuck on something. Until you finish the entire game, there's always going to be several puzzles where you don't know the solution. And sometimes the puzzles are something in the environment. So you'll just find yourself staring at some leaves and thinking, is that a maze solution? Is there a line in those leaves? Is that the same as this puzzle over here? Is that what? And then, is that shadow casting on this? If I draw a line around all the black parts and all the white parts, would that be a solution? And if so, to what? And you want to think that, like, oh, I've just lost it. I've just lost my mind. This game has driven me crazy. But the craziest time I ever thought that, it turned out to be true. It really was a solution.
I think I wish I'd gone into it having not read or heard anything its creators had said about it or claimed about it.
And oh, also so having, this entire podcast has been a spoiler.
No, the creators of the game. I mean, like,
oh, right.
So nothing that none of the claims that John Blow has made about it. I wish I'd not known any of that because, for example, he's claimed that he wants to make a game without language. And to the extent that the puzzles interact with the environment, it's language through game design. But he also puts fucking audio diaries on the floor everywhere with lengthy, tedious philosophical diatribes.
I didn't mind. I haven't minded all of them. Some of them I just can't take in because I'm doing other stuff with parts of my brain.
Got a fucking maze to solve. Yeah.
But some of them are interesting. I don't really know that the point that he seems to be driving towards, which is some kind of meditation on the pursuit of knowledge in general, or perhaps God, who knows?
Definitely God.
Well,
it, God stuff in there.
I haven't found much God stuff. Oh, okay. I haven't found all the diaries, presumably. But there's, you know, there's
got to get to the God zone. It's all in there.
I haven't been there yet. Yeah. But that's quite interesting. In, I mean, you know. Perhaps it's an unnecessary appendage to what is otherwise just quite a robust puzzle game without many higher aspirations than that. But I think some of the things that those philosophers / scientists say about pursuing knowledge does turn out to be germane to the puzzles at hand. Like there's a long meditation on what it is to be Zen, and part of, I can't forget which. Branch of Zen Buddhism, or it is that advocates this, but part of it is to set yourself impossible problems, conundrums that cannot be solved, and actually the joy is to be found in some kind of persistent state of perplexity. And there's another recording which in which I don't know who she is, but she's some American lecturer, it seems, or philosopher or something, visiting Australia and talking to some people. It's an actual recording rather than an actress. And she's talking about how the path to enlightenment is to give up what you want and to walk away from it. And although that is obviously noodly wank, at the same time, it is actually appropriate for these puzzles, because sometimes what you want is to solve a problem and you can't actually do it. And it is better at that point just to let it, you know, to not to be the stubborn oak, but to be the bamboo and what, bend in the wind.
What,
you know,
really frustrates me, though, is that it's just making something explicit that was implicit in the design of the island anyway. And what irritates me is that a lot of it is just so on the nose, and the way the game communicates with you beautifully, or like a beautiful conversation between you and the game, which is teaching you these themes. I don't need to hear like a person literally read out a text that explains that to me as I'm doing it. I found it quite irritating, actually, to be honest. But that's other people, you know.
Yeah, I've stopped activating them when I find them.
That's true. It is optional. I should stress it is optional if you see one on the floor. Yeah. It's just also again, it's so weird to see little tape recorders in this otherwise kind of very naturalistic environment.
And also, so far at least, they're the only thing in the world that you don't activate by drawing a line. Like everywhere else, even just a switch to turn a light on will be a maze puzzle, basically, with a straight line.
There's no obvious segue between that and Tomb Raider.
Isn't Tomb Raider about exploring environments and working out strange arcane machinery? Doesn't it have tombs in now? I was told this one had tombs in.
It does have tombs in.
It does have tombs.
The last one had pseudo tombs. This one has tombs that are sometimes actually boats. But they are kind of it's interesting watching. I mean, in fact, it's interesting comparison between XCOM and XCOM 2 to see this as a sequel and how it's developed and moved on. Because I enjoyed the first game with lots of caveats. It was a really a stupid game in many ways, but quite an enjoyable shooter, I thought, more than anything else. And I made a video for RPS about it, in fact, in which I opined that it was marked the end of a certain sort of cutscene-led matinee adventure style blockbuster roller coaster ride video game.
And then they went and made a sequel.
Well, I knew they were making a sequel at the time. My point in that wasn't that the Tomb Raider franchise was immediately going to wither and die.
I'll never make anything like this ever again.
It was that perhaps some of the... In fact, you know, I'm sure there'll be many more games of this sort, but they're going to begin to move away from a lot of the tropes that we would have identified with, say, the Uncharted or the Tomb Raiders of old. So it's less... I mean, The simple way to put that would be less scripting and more systems. And that seems to be the way that this game has moved. And there's, I can't think of any QTE moments in this game where a button prompt immediately appears above your head and you have to press it. Is there? I mean, yeah. There are in combat where
one,
you...
I can't remember what it was, but I remember thinking that, like, because when it happened, one of the things that went through my head is, oh, we haven't had one of those until now.
Yeah, I mean, it was such a marked difference from the beginning of the last game, which is, you know, just completely plagued by it.
Yeah, that's true.
In this game, there's less leering at Lara, which is a good sentence to say. There's less of a weird fixation upon watching her die, which is also quite pleasing. It is, I mean, it begins in a similarly linear fashion to the extent that you're walking along this kind of bridge of ice and you literally cannot fall off it. There's nothing you can do. But, in fact, the first time I died...
She's a born survivor.
That's right. But I did die in quite close to the opening sequence where you can climb across these kind of icy escarpments using your ice picks. And you can chink, chink, chink with, you know, with your little hands moving, and then you can do a little jump from one to another. But I made this leap onto another ice face that I could easily cling onto, and I just slid straight off it and died. I was like, oh, I'm sure I was in range of that. And so I tried again, slid straight off it and died. And what it wanted me to do was to get slightly closer to it before I made that leap, at which point it would play a cutscene in which the ice fell off, so I wouldn't have been able to grab it. And then you can, you plan some other different route, but so it still has those sorts of problems, and they're still desperately irritating. I don't think has many forced fails other than that. I think I've encountered one thing where I was dead sure, because my suspicion of the previous game, I might have mentioned this on a podcast before, is that sometimes some of those kind of gotcha QTEs, either the time window to press them is punishingly small the first time you play it, or you are guaranteed to fail the first time. Because at some point, because I played the game through twice, actually, as it happens, once when it first came out and once for the video. So I knew when things were going to happen, and I'd still fail. And I'd be like, my reaction, I'm an old dying man, but like my reactions aren't that bad. And I'd always get it the second time. And I've only encountered that maybe once where I thought I was pretty sure I'd hit a button when I hadn't.
I have upgraded one of my skills in Rise of the Tomb Raider that is, it's not really a QTA, but like there's a certain move you can do where you dodge someone, and then if you press the melee key at the right time, you do a counter move. And before I'd ever used that, I still don't really understand how to use it. I get that it's after you dodge, but it's not all the time that you press the dodge key. You have to be target them, but I don't actually know how to target someone. But anyway, so it sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. And so by the time I first used it, I had already upgraded it to make that window of opportunity to press that button bigger. And it makes it so big that I actually didn't understand that it shows like a circle shrinking in on the Y button. And so the success zone, I now know, is kind of shaded in gray, but the success zone filled the entire circle that it was being shrunk. And so I thought I had to wait until it hit the Y button and press that, which it turns out is more or less the only way I could have failed it. Like, it's so easy that you can only fail if you wait until it hits the Y button.
Yeah, so I think the dodge counters have to be on screen. And I think now the markers appear next to the bad guy in the world rather than just on the screen. Because sometimes I'm dodging away from somebody and the camera will be facing away from them. And I'll be pressing the dodge button, but nothing's happening. So I think, I don't know.
I'm exactly what it is. I'm really liking it in general. I thought the intro was way better and had much better like cinematic pacing. It cuts back and forth between sort of Lara in London and your icy adventures and then a Syrian adventure.
Syria is really where semi-mystical adventure series ought to go at this time. It even makes a completely bold reference to the crisis in Syria at the moment. You see kind of a city being bombarded in the distance. You're like, well, I don't want to think about that.
Tombstone raid. But that was, I thought like the pacing was good on that. And it took me a while to notice, but I realized, oh, this is a cinematic opening. I'm not hating. That's unusual. And then I really like the stealth sections. Those are, I think they're already good in the previous game, but they're even better now. There's the skills you can upgrade are cooler. And I was really liking it right up until the first time you get a assault rifle when they feel obliged to have a sort of forced combat section to make sure you understand how to use assault rifles, which I'm pretty sure they did in the last game as well. And I hated that, and I actually died to it, and I ended up setting a difficulty to trivial so that I could just get past it without having to think about it. And I just didn't want to use this hot rifle at all, and you kind of can with the bow, but it's obviously easier on easier difficulties. And then it keeps throwing in those forced combat sections where there's two things that are offensive about it. One is that I'm forced to do out-and-out combat where stealth is not an option. You can't avoid it. It's like the Mirror's Edge thing where there's some kind of barrier that you can't get past until all the enemies are defeated, which was famously unpopular in Mirror's Edge. Yeah. And then also the other bullshit thing is that the reason that it has to be all-out combat is because they've already spotted me when the scene starts, but there's no, like, realistic explanation for that. Like, I am hidden, and then just suddenly everyone shouts, oh, she's behind the mural, or that she's in front of the mural. And then when you die and restart, it will spawn you in front of them, like just out in the open in front of everybody, where I think it must expect you to have been when that scene started.
Right.
And that's when they, like, when they're shouting, she's by the mural, the position that you start in is, I think, where they think you are. But so your actual actions have no bearing on how the combat encounter goes. And then I've just been hating the combat so much. I remember, like, actually quite liking it the last game.
Mm.
And I realized it's probably because I'm playing with a gamepad this time. And so I'm 10 times worse at it than I used to be.
Yeah.
And, like, in the old game, I just remember, like, people were going on zip lines across these. I do think the areas were bigger and more open that I remember from the ones I've encountered so far anyway. But I remember people, like, going along zip lines and me headshotting them with perfect bow shots and just having a great time doing that. This situation, there's just like three people in a room with a load of cover, and I'm struggling to take them all out before they kill me. And it's no fun. But I think that's mostly because I'm using the gamepad. And secondly, because I didn't buy the shotgun when I had the chance. There's a shop, and you can use Byzantine coins to buy stuff from the enemy's, like, quartermaster. He's just in, like, a hut in the village of the people who, like, sort of, I don't know what to call them, like, tribes people that you're allied with. And he's
the former Byzantines who speak with perfect American accents sometimes, but some of them speak with English accents.
And this guy works for the enemy, the bad guys that you're fighting, but he's also just in the tribe's village and will sell things to you once you unlock his shop, and you better pay him in Byzantine coins.
Former Byzantines who live in Russia now. Anyway, sorry.
But they had a shotgun for sale and I could afford it, but the other thing for sale was a crafting tool, and you need the crafting tool to do anything better than a tier 1 upgrade to any of your weapons, so I knew that was like a vital thing I had to get, so I had to save it for the crafting tool, didn't buy the shotgun, and then later on you just get a crafting tool for free. And not having a shotgun.
You should get a shotgun later as well.
Really? Mm. And so I haven't got to that point yet. And so I've got an assault rifle, which I hate, a pistol, which I hate, the bow, which I like, but only in stealth situations and not really in, like, the middle of combat with three different people. Mm. And so the only thing I like is my climbing axes. So I'm kind of just, like, I've upgraded all of Lara's, like, worst, like, nastiest skills, the ones where she can brutally axe murder people and, like, brutally axe murder two people at a time, brutally axe murder, like, armored people. And, the last fight, I mean, it was really pissing me off, and I've just sort of decided to just axe murder everybody. And so I ran past everybody at first and then just found, like, a little ledge to hide on. And then the only way they could get to me was by walking out on this ledge around the pillar that I was hiding behind, at which point I can axe murder them. And so I just axe murdered, like, seven people in a row. And I actually thought, it was next to, like, one of these columns that you can read. I think it's Russian text in this case. And obviously, like, when you're near it during combat, it keeps telling you, too dangerous to read column. and won't let you read it. And so I didn't want to read it anyway, but, like, I was pressing the button that that activates it, and killed these six people in a row. And it was kind of out of combat at that point, so I thought, great, I'll read this column. Started reading the column, and then more people are, like, ziplining in from the ceiling and dropping down, dropping smoke grenades and stuff. And Lara doesn't stop. She carries on reading the thing and, like, starts giving her opinion about what this person meant.
Yeah,
about
you get into a good book.
Where some coins are. And while she's doing that, people are, like, shooting her point blank in the neck with an AK-47.
Is she invulnerable at that stage?
No, she's not. Right. She's still taking damage. Like, by the time it gets out of that scene, the whole screen is grey. And I still managed to, like, stab a few people with climbing axes, but then they cut me down.
Yeah, as I say, a really surprising error, I think, in the game is binding the pick up item that you can then immediately craft into a grenade on the fly, and the reload button the same button, because if you're in cover, there's usually, like, something you can craft into a grenade there, and usually if you're in cover, you're not shooting, so you probably want to reload, and those two things are consistently the wrong way around whenever I want to do them. And it's inexplicable why they put that on the same button. Mm.
The optional tombs have been amazing this time.
Yeah, really, yeah. Cool.
Like every time it warns you when there's one nearby, which is both kind of absurd, and I can imagine some people hating it, but also works really well because A, means you find the optional content, and B, just because it says on screen optional challenge tomb, when you're doing it, you can't help, when it's impressive, you can't help reflecting and think, wow, this is all optional content, that's amazing. So they get way more credit than they really deserve from me, because even though they told me where it is and like told me to go there, when I go there I'm like, that's amazing, you make all this extra content just for me. But they're like huge impressive spaces with massive unique art pieces. There's one that's like a sort of giant organ built into a mountain by hollowing out these massive columns of rock, and they're all really like distinctive. I was in near a mine recently, and when the mine was dug out, they sort of happened upon a tomb, and they'd looted all the artifacts they found and stockpiled them, and so the whole tomb, inverted commas, was actually kind of a giant mining area. And so that was like unique and cool. And it was so big that after I'd done it, I couldn't find a way back to the critical path, because no matter how far I went along the mine in the direction I thought I came from, I knew that I took a branch off to go down here. So I didn't know whether I was back on the critical path yet and I should carry on in the direction I was going, or whether I need to go all the way back. But they're like massive spaces.
Definition of tomb, very flexible. The new Tomb Raider.
Yeah. There were, I mean, I have people raided several literal tombs. A lot of the tombs were empty, but they were tombs. I love how, so I can't remember if this is true in the last one, but no, I think in the last one you used to get like submachine gun parts from the tombs and stuff. But this time you sort of read ancient texts a lot of the time. You sort of open this, they have this special kind of book thing where it has an armored cover and you have to prise that open and then read the book inside. And Lara will say something like, oh, it's a treatise on the nature and the joys of understanding it, and what that means is that trees now glow gold when I walk near them. Yeah. Like it converts whatever ancient philosophy it is into just a really crude skill for Lara.
Did you like the historical artifacts that you could pick up and rotate?
Yeah, now when you have to like discover secrets about them by just looking on the back of them.
like real archaeology, as you turn it, when it rumbles, that's when you need to keep looking at that point.
Oh, I've got rumble off, really, so learn been, stuff.
Oh yeah it as you're rotating this kind of...
It's always on the back anyway, though, so you don't really need the rumble.
So it's like this tin an old Soviet soldier had, and you turn it upside down, and then it'll add an extra line about that tin. This was probably owned by a soldier.
Lara finds a flask, and she rotates it a bit, and she's like, oh, it's half full. I was like, wow, what a secret.
I had to rotate that like 6 times before, because I've got rumble off, so I don't get any hints about this. I just keep having to rotate and like
that one's
round
on the top,
back every
actually.
Fucking detail of that thing until she finally realised, oh, there's actually liquid in it.
Oh, brilliant, Lara.
I
might need that before we're through. Oh, Lara, you wit. Oh. Which is actually the only joke that she's made in the entire thing so far. She's completely witless.
There was
the most boring fucking character.
There was also one about Tetris. Do you see that?
No, I didn't see that one.
I found an ancient version of Tetris.
That's awesome.
But I like that she has, you know, you find these, as collectibles go, them actually being historical artifacts that she then, you know, tie into some period of history that then she then has some kind of opinion about, or just reflects on, or just mentions something about. I like, because it sort of develops her as a nerd, basically. Mm. And I wish she went further in that direction. I wish that the reason she was on these quests was because she actually wanted to preserve things. Like she, you know, saw this history as valuable and wanted to understand ancient people. But it's just the most absurd sci-fi, like fantasy gumph about, you know, just mystical properties, and just, you know, believes that she's going to find something that's going to bring eternal life to all people.
Everything everyone says, like that, it's kind of like a dialogue tick, is that everyone announces their motivations in every conversation.
Yeah, there's absolutely no... I mean, it's just an entry-level dialogue at every point. So it's almost depressing, really. Although there's a conversation where Lara's pitching her next quest, basically, to a family friend. And the family friend is like, oh, you've got to give up on all this, you know, this all this magic nonsense. Oh, are you crazy? And Lara's like, oh, but I really have to. And she doesn't ever say... Oh yeah, but I actually saw a literal wizard in the last game. it's rubbish. And also, I think there does need to be an in-game explanation of why all these Byzantines who live in Russia speak perfect American accents.
Doesn't, over the course of the game, Lara learn new languages by looking at strange symbols on the wall?
Yeah, it appears to apply to text anyway.
She seems to start with, like, level zero and everything, though, so you sort of, like, buy... It's all optional, and you read murals and stuff to learn... The way language works is if you read something you don't understand, then you do understand it.
And that's then, not how language works.
The only things you really actually can't understand are the columns that tell you where money is buried nearby.
I think I would forgive a lot of the gaming silliness a lot more if there was any sort of sense of humour present in the game at all. So one of the reasons why Uncharted works for me.
Just wait till you find this Tetris joke. Solve it all.
It does all a lot of similar things, but there are actually gags in it, and it becomes this silly adventure, which it obviously is. Whereas there's something very earnest, and you're supposed to really care about Rise of the Tomb Raider in a way that is never going to happen, based on how contrived it all is, really.
I actually think the first game got away with that better, because it was going, at least in its first part, for a horror vibe. Mm. Yeah, and I think you can. It's easier. You wouldn't be able to match the appalling stuff that Lara sees. You know, she's slopping around in the guts of the 100 dead people with humour. Whereas in this second game, it just seems very just anodyne and completely tasteless.
What does everyone think of the hair tech, though?
Pretty good.
Not bad. Yeah, it's good hair tech. Her hairstyle has kind of changed to be like wider than it used to be.
I do think that is. Weird. It looks like an animal has parked on the top of her head, even though I'm consistently impressed by the hair tech. I think, I'm like, that's amazing hair, but when she's on screen...
I wear a hat most of the time, so I'm not bothered by this.
I think it looks good, but it's very, like, fresh from the hairdressers. It's kind of like, it has a puffiness that you only really get with hairspray and a lot of effort. Yeah. And so when I've just been swimming in, like, radioactive water and I come out of it, and she rinses her ponytail, to be fair, but I don't know, I don't quite get her back to...
Lots of lovely little incidental animations.
Crate and coiffure.
Even though I think the animations around the jumping and stuff are very twitchy and slightly, like, they're sacrificing the, like, animation integrity for response.
Yeah.
In a way that's quite awkward.
Yeah. I think it's probably the right choice, though.
Yeah. I'd much rather have response, definitely. But a lot of people I think it could be done better. I've seen it done better. But that, it's not bad. I could be complaining about
it. It does look quite good.
Yeah, it does. As well. Yeah, I realised I was complaining about something that, and this game actually does just look better than any other game I've ever played in many respects. But the lighting, the second location you go to in Siberia for quite a long time, I've been stuck in quite these hub locations where the light has been quite boring and quite flat. Hmm. But earlier on in the game, where you have these multiple light sources of like bright sunlight beaming in, ambient kind of light bouncing, is extraordinary. Like, technically, it's unbelievably good. It looks beautiful.
I get a lot of uncanny valleyness from the cutscenes. Like, the detail on the faces is incredible. Any screenshot looks amazing. Mm. But when you see them try to talk, they can't crease their face in a way that the emotion of the scene actually requires. And so there's a very robotic feel to it. Mm-hmm. And also, I think the performances are not good.
They can't act either. or say things that the scenes require.
I must enunciate the words on this script.
Yeah, the worst line I've heard so far is actually very, very near the beginning, where she's climbing through this, you know, terrible icy waste, and it's incredibly dangerous. And she tells her companion, who's not as good as her, to go back. And she goes, go over there with them. In a way that's...
Strange intonation.
Very strange, yeah.
I think one of those items that you can pick up and rotate is a broken pot. And she's like, this pot was beautiful once. Like, and now somebody's used it to put earth in and plant vegetables. I don't think this is the tragedy that you seem to think it is.
She does perform every line like it's a terrible, awful tragedy.
I wonder what's going on there, because there was also a voice recording where the guy just screwed up the delivery. Like, it has the text version for you to read along with, and just he joins on the first word of the next sentence into the last sentence in a way that doesn't make any sense at all. Really? And then puts the pause in the wrong place. So it just feels like whoever was overseeing the voice acting maybe didn't check some of that stuff.
Reminds me of a brilliant Stephen Fry sketch, which I'll recommend arbitrarily just so it gets in the show notes, which is of him doing a reading from an incredibly cliched horror book where a lot of the sentences are balked in very, very funny ways. And it's brilliant.
That sounds good.
He was either mad or both. is one of the lines from it. That's a little teaser there.
Talking about being mad or both, shall we do questions from questions?
Yay.
Evan Johnson writes, "Hello, Crate and Crowbar. I have been keeping track of the different themes and variations upon the alien and human interactions in video games. Because the new XCOM game is due to come out soon, I was wondering which of these themes you like to see in your video games. Personally, I enjoy Civilization Beyond Earth's interpretation of aliens being a hive-minded group who react depending upon how the humans treat them originally. Bonus question, do any of you hold any openness to belief in extraterrestrial life? Thank you for making such an amazing show, Evan."
Since you mentioned XCOM, XCOM, the Bureau Declassified, colon, whatever else, in the initial like art for that, I never played the final game, but the initial art for that with the sort of crazy cuboid sort of splintering alien obelisk things that would appear. They were just kind of bizarre geometric shapes, and then they'd like disperse into tiny cubes, and those were like legitimately alien. There was something creepy about it, particularly I think it was a good choice to kind of marry that to, you know, 50s Americana and images of like idyllic domesticity, because it was so weird and so like nasty. And I think there was some kind of like black oil as well that secreted over it.
Yeah, there was actually a really good kind of black kind of goo balls that latch onto people's faces and actually go inside them and take them over, which is definitely X-Files, but a far more enthusiastic interpretation of the kind of the X-Files blobs.
And I think sort of people's faces fragmented into squares as well. Mm. Like, I don't know if that was people aliens disguised as humans or humans being destroyed in some way. But
yeah, I forget. It was disturbing though.
Yeah, it was very memorable. You know, that was concept art for a game I never played, and I still remember it. So that's impressive. Well, and that sticks in my mind because so few aliens in games are any good at all. Like, so, like, even XCOM, which I love, the actual interpretation of aliens is just like, you know, mechanically they're interesting designs for enemies, but as visions for what aliens might be like, it's just like, oh, yeah, what's the kind of default that everyone says they're like? Oh, they're like that, yeah.
In XCOM 2, they're bizarre.
Snaky boobs.
Snaky boobs for a starter. Bizarre. Like, how these things formed an alliance. So there's a kind of psychic control idea to the XCOM thing where actually the real aliens are just co-opt subspecies and draw them into their armada, right, which was part of the first game as well. But
like Combine.
Yeah, pretty much. But without any of the, like, much sillier than the Combine. But I won't spoil how.
Actually, I mean, the Combine deserve a mention, I think, for being... Mm. Like, just the idea that there are... That it's not one alien race, it's a bunch of alien races, and there's this sort of, like... The things you're fighting are actually just slaves in the same way that, you know, they want you to be slaves. And Half-Life 2 in particular, the human enemy, or semi-human enemies that you're fighting are just sort of... you know, converted humans. And there was a nice, like, practicality to that. I remember reading the art book, or I guess just the sort of behind-the-scenes book, Raising the Bar, and talking about the design for those, for the Combine soldiers, and how they were sort of sick of giant shoulder pads in Space Marines, and they just sort of looked at what practically is best for body armor and what areas you actually need to protect, and it ends up being this kind of just... puffy suit, basically. And yeah, the sort of like unifying humans and aliens under this sort of meta force that's enslaved them all and has converted them all from their original form. So the Vortigaunts you fight are, you know, wearing special harnesses and stuff. Was kind of interesting.
Black head crabs.
yep, those are probably
not an original idea, but like probably the best example of that idea most sinister example of that idea I could think of in games.
Yeah. Can you think of any like really weird alien concepts from games? Because they're so often so conventional. Like, there's just so many games that are just about, oh, they look a bit like insects, mow them all down. Mm. Including Half-Life.
Yeah, giant fucking ants in that stupid ant bit in episode 2.
No, I think it's...
Damien writes... Dear Kookaburra and Cockatoo, g'day from Australia. I was reading a review for XCOM 2 which commented on the science tree. Being a man of science, it got me thinking about how advancement in science or technology is represented in games. Scientific discoveries in the real world have often been unintentional, e.g. penicillin, and certainly could not be placed on time and budget constraints if advancement X or Y had to be achieved with 100% certainty. In my experience, games with science trees are really well defined with clearly stated benefits, costs, and pathways to follow. Are there any unique methods of representing science or technological progression within games? Would games like XCOM be able to function if the player could only invest in research without being able to control what benefits or applications arose out of that investment? Hmm. Cheers, Damien.
The last part of that is a cool idea. The idea that, like, okay, you want to put money in science? Well, we don't know what the fuck that's going to do. Yeah. We can try and focus on some things, but we might not discover those. We might discover some totally different things.
XCOM 2 does this, but it's actually kind of a drawback for the game. So your first playthrough of XCOM 2 is going to be very reactive because you're not going to understand what researching X technology will result in. So it'll say, research Illyrium, and that'll imply that that's important, but it won't tell you why.
Right.
And so there's a kind of, when you play the game again with that foresight, it changes the game completely. Like, you know what you want to research and stuff. Apparently Stellaris is going to do stuff
more
like this.
Yeah, that's the game sprung to mind. Hmm. There was something, I remember reading about how Stellaris was going to do research and then having my own idea of what they were saying because it's an idea that makes sense to me and that I want to see, and then realizing that maybe they're not doing quite this. But the way I thought they were saying they were doing it was that research would not be a sort of thing that you do in a lab somewhere, but rather that as you defeat other races and as you explore and find things, those things would be kind of the fuel for research. Like, you need sort of alien artifacts basically to kind of to make progress on that. And so what I thought they were saying was that all research, all science would be done purely by, you know, studying things that you didn't know about before. So every time you defeat an enemy you haven't fought before, studying the remnants would give you some research boost. And if you fought an enemy you had fought before, studying its remnants would give you no research boost. And so it'd all be about the unknown. And I really love the idea that, like, every inch of scientific progress you ever make has to be fueled by something that you've never seen before. But then I can't remember what I read, but it sounded like actually that's not quite what they're going for.
Still not quite sure, but it sounds like scientific progress will be outside of your control to a degree.
Right.
So it sounds like the scientists that you recruit or happen to appear in your civilization will have certain specialties, and you might not necessarily have control over that, which is really interesting because it does, like, science when it's kind of this private sector pursuit could go into any number of areas that the government doesn't necessarily have control over, or you as a weird omnipotent kind of god being, whatever you are in a 4X strategy game, might not necessarily be able to control exactly what is researched by all scientists in your universe at any given time. And they are going to do their own things for profit and for personal gain. And it sounds like technology will be shaped by that as much as it is shaped by you. Again, we've not seen the game in action, so it's very hard to say how that's actually going to translate.
I knew that Stellaris was doing something interesting, but couldn't remember what. So before any of you mentioned it, I typed it into Google on my phone and brought up a devlog where they explain. It is based around the scientist that you hire, but as you pour points into researching stuff, what it does is when you unlock a new tech or a new bit of research, you get presented with three cards and you get to pick one of them that you get to pick. And those three cards are drawn from a massive pool of hundreds, and there's weighting taken into account, and so it's not purely random. The ones it draws are partly dependent on, as you say, the personality of the scientist, but also the ethics of the empire you're playing as, the department, the text you already have, and how far through the game you are. So it'll weight certain things to try and make the game fair in the early stages and that sort of stuff.
That is so like Jim to discover the quark. Come on, Jim. You're always looking at the fucking quarks.
And there'll be certain, you know, items of research that will be super rare, and it'll flag those up. So if you get those in a hand of three, you know that if you pass that up, then you probably never come up again during your game and that sort of stuff.
That's interesting.
Galsiv 2 sprung to mind because although it does have a traditional tech tree and you do just work towards things that you already know what the advantages will be, every now and then you'll sort of, as you explore anomalies and stuff, one of the perks that you can get from those will just be that the thing you're researching right now, you just complete it immediately. So it's going to be 52 weeks to research the thing, but the thing you discovered, that already has that technology, bam, you just got it.
Chris McDonald writes, I have been employing my niece's Lego to solve puzzles in The Witness. Have you used tools outside of games to solve them?
Yes.
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 Particularly for The Witness.
Yeah. In fact, I think The Witness's iPad paradigm is not the ideal way to solve many of those puzzles.
Yeah.
In fact, some form of notation would be really useful, which is why I often print screen and open Photoshop.
I have a very specific idea of what I want from The Witness, because it's... I do like taking notes in games. I do like when, I've got to get my notepad out for this because it's complicated. And I loved her story where I was constantly alt-tabbing out to a text document where I'd meticulously organize my notes by date and everything. And if the game could provide me that functionality itself, that would be great too. But I didn't mind going out to an external program for that. With The Witness, I kind of do mind. And I don't hate it. It's fine. But it feels like a failing of the game that the best way to solve these puzzles is to use a different tool. I feel like the game should be the best tool to solve these puzzles if it's solely about these puzzles.
I think the difference there is that her story, the process of deduction, is something that comes after the fact of you recording all the data.
Yeah,
whereas in The Witness, sometimes you have all the data. It's just you need to be able to cross-reference it in a laborious way.
Yeah, exactly. The exciting thing about her story is the stuff I was writing down, I wasn't copying out things from the game. I was writing my own ideas. I was like, I think I know this has happened. What I wish The Witness had was like one button to screenshot, basically, and then scroll through the screenshots of the mouse wheel or whatever, and then the button that you normally use to kind of draw the lines in the maze would just be a kind of free draw on the screen. And so if you're looking at an old photo of a previous thing, you can draw on it for reference, or if you're looking at the actual puzzle in real time, you draw on it to solve the puzzle. Maybe some way to sort of see a screenshot and real time at the same time, like it's sort of 50% opacity or something like that. Because that's what you really need. That's what I do. I've used Photoshop to solve Witness puzzles. I was using EarthenView, like you, Tom.
Yeah.
And for some of them, it's fine because I just want to draw on the solution. Because that's the thing that I think is a flaw, is that Photoshop or Paint or any paint program is a better way of testing solutions and trying things out than The Witness itself is, because it's just awkward to, you know, get your cursor around the lines the right way, and then when you make a mistake, it's harder to undo it in that than it is in a paint program. And then later on there are ones about spatial manipulation and sort of thinking about, okay, I have these six different shapes and I've got to fit them in somehow at different arbitrary rotations. And for that, I used Photoshop and I made them all in separate layers and I rotated them. I'm pretty sure it's the same puzzle the guy is saying about the Lego pieces, which actually is a better idea. If I had Lego pieces to hand, I would have used that. Somebody else told me that they cut them out from cardboard and held them up in front of the screen to do that, which I think that would have been better than Photoshop as well.
I like the idea that I've not encountered that level of puzzle yet in The Witness, but I like the idea that I'm going up my own tech tree outside of the game, going from like EarthView to like Photoshop and getting into layers and stuff. But that is also dumb. I would say Legend of Grimrock is a very good example of this tradition, where there's no map, but it's a very kind of the topography is very simplistic, kind of grid-based dungeons, but you're encouraged in certain modes of that game. I think you can have maps if you want them, but you're encouraged to map them out online. People do this on lined paper all the time. And they're like, here's the switch, and here's the kind of... And people take a lot of kind of... There's a tactile pleasure to actually mapping things out for yourself. That's actually quite nice.
Yeah, I do like that. I think the reason I haven't used a notepad in The Witness is just that so much of the work would just be copying out what's on screen. And so it just feels silly because I can just take a screenshot.
Like, drawing endless chessboards.
It's not like if you're in the maze and you're walking around the maze, then you need to draw it out to be able to visualize it. But The Witness shows you all the information on screen most of the time. And so you just need a screenshot of it.
Adam Walker writes, I think the bulbs from your bowl problem are silica gel to stop moisture in the packages.
I had forgotten that I'd even mentioned my bowl problem on a previous podcast, so this tweet was a surprise to me.
I haven't listened to the previous podcast. What is your bowl problem?
I bought a new laptop. I can't think why I would have been telling you this, but I bought a new laptop and in amongst the packaging was just spilling hundreds of tiny little really hard clear plastic balls that just get everywhere. They're just all in my carpet. I'm still finding them all over the place. And I guess that there was some kind of drying mechanism that was supposed to be in some kind of bag, and the ball bag had burst and the balls had spilled out.
Yeah.
Okay. Anders Russell writes, PC-based GM tools. Armor 3's Zeus toolset has a lot of potential, is surprisingly deep, and is fairly straightforward. And as a bonus, you can smite unruly players with lightning and or A10 gun runs. I'm assuming this is also a response to a previous discussion.
Yeah, our previous question was asking if there are good PC tools for doing basically DMing, like being a dungeon master and running a role-playing game. And I guess that's being a dungeon master for Armor 3.
I've mucked around with them a little bit. They are really cool. Obviously, Armor 3 has a big community just creating custom scenarios, but this lets you basically use some of those same tools while running a live game. So you can have a GM which, you know, spawns a patrol just over the horizon that comes towards you, or spawns a tank somewhere nearby for you to find, or, you know, doing all these sorts of things on the fly, changing time of day, changing weather.
It's, I remember, cool. Gary's mod has an RPG game mode that, you know, is an unofficial mod type thing for it, that involves GMing basically. Like every, it's always role playing, so you're always told what your roles are and what, you know, fiction you're living out, and everyone has to kind of play by the rules. And that's led to some cool stories.
I always liked Sleep is Death. I don't know if you covered that last time.
We did.
I'll call out Roll 20 as a just a very direct DM to player tool.
Oh, yeah.
Joshua Vorderman writes, you asked which game has the best snow. It's Dirt Rally. You can get stuck in snow mounds or use them as a soft barrier. I agree. I don't know that I love the snow in Dirt Rally specifically, but I love the landscapes and the weather in that game. I'm no good at rally driving whatsoever, but I quite like parking. All rally courses take place in kind of mountainous terrain surrounded by beautiful forests stretching off towards the horizon, and it's just nice to pull up a night map, turn on the rain, and park somewhere looking at some trees. Spend some time with it.
It's got a good kind of rain pattering against the windscreen sound effects. It's very therapeutic, that, somehow.
Yeah.
Rise of the Tomb Raider. I keep wanting to call it Tomb Raider Rising, because the last one was Tomb Raider Origins, clearly, and this is Tomb Raider Rising, so they got both the cliches out of the way. Has good snowdrift technology. I said this last week, but I hadn't actually played it at the time. I just remember the E3 demo having some really cool wading through snow stuff. And you can indeed wade through snow, and it does leave cool trails. It doesn't totally make sense. There are some times when you see someone sort of standing in midair because you've actually waded through that snow, and so the MIP mapping or whatever is telling you that it's actually, you know, really deep at that point, but the actual game physics is saying that person can stand on the surface of it. Deep snow prevents you from jumping and rolling and stuff. And the sort of like three or four things that can prevent Lara from running, that hinder Lara's movement speed, are if she's injured, like from a recent fall in a cutscene, that slows her down. If she's wading through deep snow, that slows her down. And then the slowest and most agonizing thing of all is if there's any kind of friendly NPC around. In which case, you are reduced to a crawl and you can barely move because the fucking NPC has to talk to you and it's probably loading the next assets in.
Yeah.
Good snow in Company of Heroes 2, which deep snow does affect Lara, but it doesn't seem to be in the game that much. Like, the game puts in a set piece where it punishes you with a bear.
Oh, yeah.
For going the wrong way in the fleeing sequence. Which was brutal.
If you touch the deep snow, the cutscene's over.
Yeah, the bear gets you.
Did this happen for you? When I killed the bear, and after I killed it, I went over to loot it by hacking open its belly with my pickaxe, as one does. And, of course, Lara was slightly upset about having to do this. She went, oh, made some kind of pitiful noise. And at the same time, a pop-up for the game's microtransactions on the screen. I think it was microtransactions. It's something called gift packages anyway. I didn't look into what it was, but I assume it's some kind of cosmetic bullshit. But did that happen?
No, I haven't had that.
No.
Oh, right, okay.
I found those things in a menu. I've no idea what they are, but it didn't reward me with gift packages for
I'm not sure it was rewarding with me. I think it was just telling me about them.
Have you guys experimented at all? I haven't played the game, but I've read about it. Have you guys experimented with I think they're called wild cards or something like that? Cards that you can apply that modify the gameplay in certain ways?
No. Never heard of that.
You can get, I think that there may be DLC things you can purchase, but I think you also unlock some of them through playing, but they're like mutators, basically. You can play the game so that Lara is constantly on fire at all times.
Right.
Or play the game through so that, like, squirrels increase your hunger if you eat them. Make it so all the enemies are on fire at all times. All sorts of stuff that seems to suggest that there's someone somewhere has a sense of humor about this game. They're just quite happy to break the canon of it.
So there's a menu option that's about replaying missions, and I can't remember what it's called.
But Expeditions.
Oh, yeah, that's it. Because yeah. I clicked on that because that sounded great. And yeah, then it turned out it was like replay things you've already done, but with a score attack on, or like... I imagine that's where mutators come into it.
Mm. And that's all the time for questions that we have.
You can send us questions at questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You can tweet at us at creightoncrowbar. That was an at symbol, not just the word at. And you can back us on Patreon, which is patreon.com/creightoncrowbar. You can join us in the Discord room. I almost said that wrong because I've learned recently, but there's also a service called Discourse, which is very similar. But we're on Discord, and the URL for that is in our post somewhere. And you can follow us individually. I am at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
Great. I am at Gonis, GONNAS.
I'm Tom Senior, at PCGLudo.com.
I'm at Marsh Davis,
DAVIES.
Lovely.
Thank you for listening,
everybody.